The very expensive cup is coming. Will Miami cash in? Wasserman Schultz is not invited to the 20th, and gang violence postpones Haiti's long overdue election yet again. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we will count all that Soccer World Cup money we expect to come our way next month, $657 million, and that's the price for one ticket. Just kidding. We'll also discuss why the Democratic Black Caucus of Broward County is urging Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz not to seek re-election in Florida's new 20th district, and we'll ask if Haiti can ever hold a new presidential election, something it hasn't had since 2015. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. This week, we noticed a brilliant billboard advertising campaign for the Canadian airline Air Transat. It takes countries in the upcoming Soccer World Cup, then shows you how much less a ticket to fly to a country is compared to how much a ticket for one of its World Cup matches is. $799 round trip to see Portugal, $3,870 to watch Portugal. Portugal is one of the teams that will play here in Miami at Hard Rock Stadium in Miami Gardens when the World Cup opens in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico a month from now on June 11th. And those billboards aren't that far off. World Cup tickets and parking and everything else are exorbitant. Even so, a motherload of hotel, restaurant, retail, and other revenue is promised for host cities like Miami. The seven matches that will be played here are in fact expected to directly bring in $657 million. That sounds like a pretty decent return on the $46 million Miami-Dade County is shelling out for services like security, if that is, those golden expectations are realized. Joining me now here in the studio to assess that potential windfall and the potential shortfall of Miami's World Cup adventure is WLRN's Tom Hudson. Tom, how are you?
I am terrific, Tim. Thanks for the invitation.
And we'd like to have our listeners tell us what you think of the World Cup costs. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Tom, let's start with the World Cup money issue that's foremost on everyone's minds, and that's the rather astonishing ticket prices that those Canadian billboards capture. Yeah. The last time a men's soccer World Cup was held here in the U.S. in 1994, I paid $25 to see Spain and Germany play in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Now, hit me with what it's going to cost me to attend a match in 2026, well, starting with that Portugal-Colombia match.
Listen, if that 1994 ticket for the World Cup first-round match would have just kept pace with inflation, you'd be spending $52 here in 2026 for that ticket.
Okay, I could still do that.
You could swing that, maybe? Maybe you and I could go for a C-note, perhaps? So the secondary market, I just looked for the lowest price ticket for Colombia versus Portugal at Hard Rock Stadium, 100 times more than what you paid in 1994. 100x, $2,300 a ticket. That does not include parking, by the way.
Which will probably be...
another couple hundred dollars, perhaps.
Right, yes. That's what I've read. Yeah. Right, okay. Yeah. Yeah. All right, so I'm going to be sitting at home watching that game on Fox then.
Okay.
But in your reporting this week, you mentioned that European fans have actually filed a complaint with the European Commission against soccer's world governing body known as FIFA because of these prices.
Yeah, this is a fascinating argument. They're essentially claiming that FIFA has a monopoly over its own tickets for the World Cup, that FIFA itself sells the tickets.
Yeah.
It makes claims that FIFA's advertising isn't exactly transparent about the actual ticket prices when they... FIFA says, oh, $60 World Cup tickets, but in fact, those tickets are very, very few and very, very far between. Very rare to find those dynamic pricing, so the more people who are looking for tickets, the higher the ticket prices go.
There was a lottery originally but that was not the secondary market, which is where most people end up
having
to buy.
Yeah. The lottery was to win the right to purchase a primary ticket.
All right.
And then so you get that ticket, and then you could sell it in the secondary market, and that's where we've seen these prices just explode.
And were only competing with about a billion people around the world.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
So speaking of FIFA, whose reputation for financial integrity isn't exactly stellar when you look at its long history of corruption scandals, many of which you and I have covered, mm-hmm. walk us through the contract structure local governments like Miami-Dade County must accept when doing business with the organization for an event like the World Cup.
I mean, there's only one World Cup, and there's only one World Cup organizing entity, right, which is FIFA. So it does have the monopoly on this this beautiful game. And so it is able to extract terms from local governments to be host cities to host these games. And among the terms is that the local governments essentially are entirely responsible for security. And that's an important part here of the World Cup experience, of course. Mm-hmm. But the cost of that security can be astronomical, especially when you're putting together seven games right over the course of a month, like we are here in Miami. So there's those kinds of costs to it. There's the fan fest types of costs to it. One of the other things that has come to light is FIFA will require the local governments to essentially pay FIFA back for the local taxes that FIFA would pay for hotel bed taxes and sales taxes and those types of things.
Okay.
Yeah.
We have Ian on the line from Coral Gables. Ian, what are your thoughts about this, this money ball we're talking about here?
Hello. I can't help but make connections to, every time there's been a new stadium built, not just in South Florida, but across the U.S. where, they subsidize local tax dollars, and whether or not those deals actually bring in the actual revenue promised, I will always be skeptical. I love soccer in South Florida, I'm trying to think of the Strikers and trying to think of the Miami Fusion and even Inter Miami. And
wow, that goes a long way back. You sound like you're almost as old as I am.
I'm definitely not. I don't think my father.
Definitely not.
But
definitely.
I would just say I especially would look forward to riding the Metro Rail to Hard Rock, since that would make all of this so much easier, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Those
are good points, Ian. Thanks. Now, Tommy, as you were mentioning, the local governments, of course, pony up the money for necessaries like security, permitting. And I mentioned the $46 million Miami-Dade is forking over. The city of Miami's contribution is about $12.5 million. What does all that entail?
Yeah, most of it for the county is security, right? Is law enforcement and security provided for the games. For the city of Miami, a lot of that goes to the fan fest. Some of it's in kind, some of it's a hard dollar cost. And some of those dollars also wind up, particularly in the county's instance, when it comes to the security spend, gets reimbursed by FEMA, by the federal government.
Uncle Sam.
That's right. Still tax dollars. Like, let's not pretend they get somewhere else. It's just coming from a different source. The big, beautiful bill that President Trump signed, many, many moons ago included lots of money in there for host committees. And Florida, Miami received the most money than any of the American cities that are hosting the World Cup in order to help defer the cost, the local spending on primarily on security.
So it sounds like, at the end of the day, this is not a bad deal for Miami.
For Miami, it's probably not, honestly. Josh Ceballos, our local government reporter, and I kind of crunched the numbers. And, the $650 million direct economic impact is kind of the total revenue, right?
Right.
So that's lodging, that's restaurants, that's transportation, it's recreation. Yeah. When you strip out of that, what a part of that gets returned to local governments with local hotel taxes, local sales taxes, it's in the tune of a few dozen, tens of millions of dollars. Yeah. So it's not an awful deal.
Yeah. So, as I was saying, for that investment, host cities like Miami, they do count on big revenue returns from the hospitality and retail tsunami the World Cup brings in from around the globe. Again, this is a worldwide event. FIFA has made what many consider a rather exaggerated claim about what Miami expects to rake in. The reality is more like half of its estimate, right?
The $1.3 billion figure.
Yeah, but still, even half looks like a pretty good haul. If it materializes, and what guarantee does Miami have that? That $650 plus million cash-in will materialize.
It does. There is no guarantee of it. But what Miami has going for it here, a couple of things that Miami has going for it that really the other U.S. cities don't. I mean, one is a population that knows international soccer. I mean, the Colombia-Portugal game here is the singular highest-priced ticket right now, is drawing tens of thousands of people to South Florida to try to see the game either in person or, of course, just to be around it with the environment. I mean, it is the singular game of the opening round of all of the World Cup. That's one thing. Second thing is this is the low season for hospitality and tourism in South. In Boston, it's not. Atlanta, it's not. Seattle, it's not. Right. This is the high season. So this is adding dollars here. It's really kind of new dollars where these hotels and restaurants and transportation Uber drivers may not be as busy, if not for the World Cup.
And I want to get to that hotel factor in a second here. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Tom Hudson about the economics of the Soccer World Cup that's coming to Miami starting next month, how expensive it will be, but how lucrative it could also be. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Tom, we were just talking about the big revenue return on investment that Miami-Dade stands to see in this World Cup. I thought one of the most interesting things in your reporting this week, though, was the breakdown of how much each of the seven matches being played here stands to bring in. I want to briefly run down those with you, starting with the four first round or group round matches.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. So those are seen as a couple of what the kind of economic econometrics here will call major games, and some of them are minor games, right? And so the major, you know, the major game example is the Colombia-Portugal game.
Exactly.
It's a great example, right? And so that's expected to be a higher impact total revenue generated of about $110 million for each of the four major games that are across the schedule. So that first round game of being Portugal. Minor games, still not so bad, $72 million in generated revenue, and that's direct revenue.
But one of those games is Brazil and Scotland, and Brazil is always a big draw no matter who it's playing.
Brazil could be one of those big draws that could, you know, again, push those numbers even higher.
Exactly. But then we move to the knockout rounds.
Yep.
Miami is hosting a match in the round of 32, and then the quarterfinals when things really start to get exciting.
Yep.
And the revenue seems to jump significantly,
Yeah, because those are those major games, right? Because you're really going to see the hotels be able to increase prices, Airbnb hosts are going to be able to increase prices. There's going to be more people likely coming to want to enjoy the environment who may not be able to get the ticket at Hard Rock, but they're going to be at the Fan Fest in Bayfront Park in the city of Miami, or just want to come to South Florida with a group of other soccer fans and be with them.
And so then the potential revenue of those games for Miami-Dade
gets amped up. It could be $110, $115 million. Again, that's in total revenue generated mostly through lodging, transportation, and recreation.
Now, going back to that hotel point you were making earlier, you also point out that Miami is actually a bright spot for the World Cup in terms of things like hotel bookings and the Fan Fest. In other host cities, though, you mention hotel bookings look well below expectations so far. What's dragging those numbers down in those other cities, and why is Miami looking much better in comparison?
I think a couple of things. I think one are high expectations becoming unfulfilled. I think the higher hotel rates that some of those hoteliers expected to charge and have tried to charge, the market not bearing that, and $4.50 gasoline and higher airfare is also part of it, where folks may have not been planning their trip right away, and all of a sudden they've seen airfares jack up, or they've seen the price to travel increase pretty substantially.
Is one of the factors, though, that one of the biggest fan bases for the World Cup is obviously Latin America, and if you're a Latin American who wants to come see this tournament, Miami is going to be your city of choice.
I would think it would be a short list, and Miami would be number one on that
list. And I would think that would really help jack up these numbers that you're talking
about. The demand increases, And again, it's coming at a time when you're normally seeing a low tourism season, and so the hospitality industry really welcoming this kind of business.
Now, one of the other factors that I often hear talked about with the other cities, and in Miami as well, is the fear amongst groups like Latinos that the federal government, that federal immigration reform is going to be hovering around these stadium sites, perhaps
We'll have to see. I mean, it certainly is a real fear. I mean, we were just talking, a half hour, 45 minutes ago with Jake Shore, investigative reporter in Palm Beach County, about how intensive some of the immigration enforcement has been in Palm Beach County, for instance. And remember, a World Cup isn't just going to keep people staying in Dade County, right? Where Hard Rock Stadium is located, but of course, South Florida in general, it is going to attract people to the entire three county region. And we'll have to see what federal immigration looks like. We know that the Department of Homeland Security is a significant law enforcement participant in the total kind of shield operation of law enforcement when it comes to these big global events that the World Cup matches are going to present.
Yeah. Now, we should also point out, as I think you just mentioned, that this is not just a Miami-Dade phenomenon. No. We should point out that because Hard Rock Stadium sits on the border between Miami-Dade and Broward counties, the rest of South Florida stands to see a piece of this World Cup revenue pie as well, right?
Indeed, yeah. Total expectation is about somewhere between 70% to 75% of the kind of World Cup direct spend will be in Dade County, and about 25% of it could be in Broward County. Now, it's a little bit different when it comes to lodging, where Broward County will get about 40% roughly of the hotel revenue, and Dade County about 60%. Some of that is driven by folks seeing and hearing who are outside of Florida saying, "Oh, I'm going to Miami, and we'll book something on the beach or something closer to downtown Miami," not really knowing the transportation logistics of where the stadium is, as witnessed just the caller that we just spoke to, Ian, because some of Broward County tourism officials have said, as they see repeat customers to F1, the first season of F1 with the Miami Grand Prix, a lot of folks stayed in Miami. And as they come back, they now stay in Hollandale Beach. They'll stay in Hollywood. They'll stay in someplace that's in Broward County, but closer to Hard Rock Stadium because they get to know the geography better.
Mm-hmm. What about the key? I mean, do we imagine that a lot of people also want to go down to Monroe County?
And the
Keys.
Just as a tour guide here, Tim, you can't come to South Florida not come to the Keys or the Everglades if you can help it. But there is that spillover effect. That's that indirect spend, right? If somebody coming to South Florida, coming for one match, maybe two matches, but then stretching out, let me be here for a week. Let me be here for 10 days. Where else can I go? What else can I see? Yeah. And the tourism officials, are banking on that kind of indirect spend. Yeah.
And speaking of the rest of the South Florida region, you also report the counties are getting together for security measures like anti-terrorism operations.
Yeah, right? Very, very important. Right, it's a multi-agency kind of umbrella shield that gets put into place. These law enforcement officials and agencies, though, in South Florida are well-oiled machines when it comes to these kind of big events between national football championships, Super Bowls, F1, Miami Open, National Hockey League championships, right? NBA championships. This is a well-oiled machine for them.
And the name of this operation is
Lasso 3. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the thing that stood out to me, this is soccer we're talking about. So is Lasso named for Ted Lasso?
I think it's more of the verb.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Just wanted to check on that.
Fair enough.
I've been talking to WLRN's Tom Hudson. Tom, thanks as always.
Thank you, sir.
Still to come, why Broward's Black Democratic Caucus has disinvited Debbie Wasserman Schultz to run in Florida's new 20th. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. If you joined us for last week's show, you heard us discuss Governor Ron DeSantis' new and very red congressional district map for Florida. It gives Republicans four more seats for a total of 24 out of 28, leaving Democrats with just four instead of the eight they once had. Three of those remaining blue districts are here in South Florida, where there used to be five. That means five Democratic South Florida U.S. representatives are now vying for just three seats in this November's midterm elections. One of them, the 20th District, sitting in Broward County, has long been considered a seat for a black representative, like the late iconic Alcee Hastings. And so Broward's Democratic Black Caucus is urging white Democratic representatives like Debbie Wasserman Schultz, whose current district, the 25th, also in Broward, has now been turned into a GOP stronghold, not to run for re-election in the 20th. It's a hard example of the hard choices Florida Democrats have to make now in the next 6 months. Let us know what you think about this new and admittedly racial tension among South Florida Democrats. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio to discuss this is the president of the Broward County Democratic Black Caucus, Corey Scheer. Mr. Scheer, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks for having us here. We definitely want to have our voices heard.
I understand. In the Broward Democratic Black Caucus's statement, you emphasize that, quote, black voters have always been the soul of the Democratic Party, and Florida's 20th congressional district has been an anchor of black political representation for over three decades. We have a duty to speak on what happens to it next, end quote. Mr. Scheer, can you remind us of the history of the area that has traditionally made up the 20th and why it did become considered a seat that a black representative should hold?
Yeah, first of all, it's not an easy journey, like the journey of most African Americans in America. It's a successful journey, though, a journey of overcoming and excelling. So it took 116 years since Reconstruction for Alcee Lamar Hastings, the man from Alamante, to be able to ascend to congressional office. Now, that doesn't mean that he didn't run before. He ran in up to 1990. I have a flyer of his where he ran for Secretary of State trying to get out the black vote. But that vote was never enough, right, in order for us to win and excel. However, in CD20, we were able to have at least a minority majority, as well as other voters, decide that Alcee was the one that they wanted. And so in 1992, and he was actually sworn in 93, which was my senior year at Georgetown University. So I had the privilege of interning for a gentleman that we grew up with, you know, who was someone that we interacted with. Right. So that black voice comes in. And listen, not only at that point, he's dealing with things such as Haitian repatriation, dealing with wars and issues in the Horn of Africa and across Africa, but eventually even ascends to be the first American to be elected to the Helsinki Commission and have input into Eastern Europe, a black man from around the Deep Side area,
Broward County. We're talking about the area north Broward County and some of southern Palm Beach County as well.
Exactly right.
Right, okay. Yeah. So that explains the history, you know, and I appreciate that you taking us through that. But the Broward Black Caucus's statement goes on to address Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz more directly. It says, quote, "We acknowledge the new map dismantled much of your current district. The new map produced other districts where your record would make you a strong candidate. None of them is this one," end quote. Now, Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz says she doesn't know yet which district she'll choose. She's only said this.
I will be running in a district that continues to allow me to represent and fight for the people of South Florida.
So why did your caucus, Mr. Scheer, feel it was urgent to warn her not to run in the 20th?
First of all, let's say this. If you're not on the table, you're on the menu. We've experienced that. Right. Our community as well has had many people tell us that, hey, you don't have the money, or you're too young, or this isn't your time. This isn't your time to run. We realize that's been said to us.
Something that all changed three decades ago, as you said, in the 1980s Congressman Alcee Hastings.
Right? But we also felt a need to speak up. The other thing that had happened is that now District 20 is compacted. It's all in Broward. So even though we were the Broward County Democratic Black Caucus, and we had an agreement, especially with our state body, that both the Palm Beach and Broward could speak on this issue, we knew that it was our duty to speak on this, with this district now being totally in Broward. And we wanted to speak strongly, because if you don't speak strongly, people don't hear you. So since that time, we've heard from many people, as you can imagine. I've spoke with Debbie Wasserman Schultz up to yesterday for like an hour, 2 days ago, for an hour. And we're not saying that she's not a cardinal member of Congress, that she hasn't had many victories, that she hasn't stood with us as an ally on certain things. We're just saying that, hey, we don't want to suffer a loss of a voice in the Congressional Black Caucus. We don't want to suffer a voice of some a loss of somebody who has our lived experiences just because DeSantis and Trump decided that they would do a legal action and write you out of your seat.
Now, speaking of that new map, this morning, opponents of Governor DeSantis's new Florida congressional map went to court in Tallahassee to get it struck down as a violation of the state's constitutional prohibition on political gerrymandering. What do you hope comes out of this court fight, especially as it concerns the 20th district?
It's very interesting. I think the number one thing is to overturn the illegal action, right? We know for sure that the Fair District Amendment from 2010, which has been recognized even in other Supreme Court rulings, they've alluded to the Fair District Amendment, thinking a ruling as late as 2024. Calais, of course, is a disaster and a distress, and really, you know, bringing us back to the pre-civil rights movement, and maybe even further, maybe pre-Reconstruction.
Right, and I want to ask you about that a little later in our conversation.
Yeah, but, you know, for us, you know, the number one thing is that we have to you know, speak to the issues. We have to continue to represent the members of our caucus, number one, as well as the voters in CD 20.
Now, let's look at the 20th. It's current representative, Democratic Congresswoman Sheila Cherfalis McCormick, who is Black and Haitian American, recently resigned the seat amid a House ethics investigation and amid the federal indictment she's under for embezzlement of federal funds. There is a crowded field in the Democratic primary to replace her, including Cherfalis McCormick herself now, it turns out. Are you confident that those candidates would be as strong as Wasserman Schultz in a general election?
So that's our other concern, by the way, Tim, is that, you know, we have a lot of need for Debbie Wasserman Schultz to continue. We think that she really is opening herself up potentially to more of a disaster, because in this district, you just had two special elections as well as a regular primary and general election. And in those elections, the majority of voters in a contested field voted heavily for Sheila Cherfalis McCormick, as well as Dale Honus, who's also a candidate as well. Now you have Luther Campbell. You have Dr. Rudy Moise, who ran twice against Frederica Wilson and is not new to that. And you have Elijah Manley, who a lot of young people are supporting. Even, by the way, some of the children of the supporters of other candidates, those young people are also supporting Elijah. So our concern is that she would actually lose, that she can't get that vote number, right, in order to win. And I don't even want us to be blamed for that.
But what are your thoughts on Congresswoman Cherfalis McCormick announcing now that she will run again for the 20th seat in spite of all her legal controversies?
Listen, I think many people are concerned. They do think that she should focus on her legal battle. But at the same time, like I'm going to reiterate now, we're not saying that anyone should not run in the sense that they don't have a right to run. So Sheila definitely has a right. But I do think many of the Black candidates are beginning to speak together. And definitely by the time we have our Black caucus meeting on Monday, I hope that they would decide. Some of them are already starting to drop out.
Now, one of the Black Democratic candidates running in the 20th, former rap star Luther Campbell, who you mentioned earlier, said this week that it's, quote, disgusting, despicable, and appalling, end quote, for Wasserman Schultz to consider running in the 20th. He went on to say, quote, I welcome her to get in this race. I will drag her, end quote. Do you worry that this is generating the sort of divisive intra-party acrimony that might not be all that beneficial for the Democratic Party come November?
I would. But again, you know, I'm going to talk about what are we getting right. This district is compacted. We definitely have a voice. More people are going to get in the race because Luther Campbell is involved. We're seeing a lot of young people pay attention, also with Elijah Manley. There are a lot of people in the middle age range that know Luther Campbell and have grown up with him as a defender of the First Amendment, as well as somebody who's provided entertainment, as well as resources to many people, including the football community. So I welcome his addition. I just know at some point some of these candidates are going to drop out, but at least they will bring people in and let people really tune in and pay attention to the race.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Corey Scheer of Broward County's Democratic Black Caucus about its call to Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz not to run in Florida's new 20th congressional district. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Mr. Scheer, I want to go back to those comments Black Democratic congressional candidate Luther Campbell made this week about the possibility of Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz, who is Jewish, running in a historically Black district like the 20th. That's because Mr. Campbell went on to say that if she does run in the 20th, quote, the relationship between the Jewish community and the Black community will be over at that moment, end quote. How do you prevent that sort of Black-Jewish rift in the party here that seems to be perhaps developing because of this?
Well, let's say this. I mean, being black in America and in the world really is not monolithic. So there are black Jews as well that I know many, Denise, with the Jewish Federation. They're black Muslims as well who've, mm-hmm. who've been here. I mean, since
sure.
Thomas Jefferson had his first Ramadan iftar dinner in the White House and a Quran as well. So it's not a monolithic entity. I do think that the relationship is strong between the black community and the Jewish community. My former roommate, Rabbi Ian Pear in Jerusalem, as well as my other roommate, Jeff Rothschild, I know they're proud of me of taking this stand. Now, I've been studying Islam. I call myself a Judeo-Christian Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
I think
all three are Abrahamic faiths.
So, exactly,
yeah,
right.
All, right.
Mm-hmm. And we're born out of that, you know, mm-hmm. so that's not new. I don't think there's any danger of that. I'm worried about people, you know, using words like anti-Semitic. I hope that people understand that just because you're worried about maybe somebody overvaluing Netanyahu, or you're worried about the war that just took place in Gaza actually still going on, the number of journalists killed, the number of innocent people killed, and you say, hey, I don't think that your values line up with me, that's not being anti-Semitic. And just having those concerns are definitely not anti-Semitic or even anti that individual.
Is there an understanding in the black community, though, in there in that part of Broward County, that given the very large Jewish population of Broward County, there's maybe a sense in that community that they, too, are entitled, let's say, to a certain amount of political representation, as does the black community feel that way in Broward?
Yeah, I think so. So listen, we can be competitive, right, without being destructive, even in the same district. There are many people, Michael Friend, who's running for office, that's been a great ally. Some of the members of the Jewish community, we continue to celebrate each other, and we're actually starting to open. We're seeing people open up that, hey, in these times, right, when you have to rely on your faith, you need a rabbi, you need a pastor, and you need an imam. And I think that we're leaning more into faith, we're leaning more into each other.
Yeah.
I don't see this really becoming a problem. I think you can be competitive without being destructive, and I'm okay. seeing that daily.
Now, I think we also have to mention, as you started to mention earlier in our conversation, the recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling that struck down what it called improper racial gerrymandering in Louisiana's congressional map. It didn't completely strike down the Voting Rights Act that allows for black and minority congressional districts, but it has certainly opened the floodgates in Republican-led states like Tennessee to eliminate those districts. Has that given the Broward Black Caucus more urgency to protect what it considers a black designated district here?
I think so. You know, the Calais decision, which just eviscerated, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, the attack on the Civil Rights Amendment, the fact that we haven't been able to get John Lewis Voting Rights Act, in spite of him being a great American mm-hmm. and what he faced on the Edmund Pettus Bridge and then went on to greatness, right? When we look at Harry and Harriet Moore, two individuals who were bombed in their home on Christmas Eve for standing up, actually helping to start the NAACP from Brevard in Broward and several other counties. And we can't get the Voting Rights Act in their name passed. And we can't even get the Welcome to Florida Act passed, even these softballs. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of concern. We feel that maybe we're back in the 50s, and we're not sure that this is in the 1850s, not the 1950s.
Yeah.
This is serious.
We have Cheryl and Kendall on the line. Cheryl, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Thanks for offering your perspectives here.
Hi, I am in Kendall right now, but I live in that district. I live in Plantation.
Ah, okay.
I think it's all hands on deck, considering what DeSantis and the legislature have done, Democrats. So I think it's all hands on deck, and I don't think it's fair to tell Debbie Wasserman Schultz not to run in that district. If she can get more votes because she's more well-known, then she has the right to run. And I would vote for her, depending on who else would be, you know, in that runoff, which I'm sure there will be one. Mm-hmm. It certainly won't be Shirtless McCormick. She has not cleared herself, and I would never vote for her.
Okay. Cheryl, again, just to confirm, you live in the new 20th district, you said?
Yes. Okay. I live in Plantation.
Okay.
Yes.
So, Mr. Scherer, just to end things here, your response to Cheryl's
perspective
there?
I appreciate that, Tim. And Cheryl, listen, I hear you, right? And I also hear from a lot of my members. And many are saying, hey, we'd rather lose our voice, we'd rather lose a seat at the table in the Congressional Black Caucus than lose Debbie. So, listen, we spoke very strongly. We asked her not to run. I've spoken to her many times since then. And many of us have spoken to her, and we're realizing that she may run. What we're saying now is we just don't think it's a good idea. And by the way, there are many people who will continue to support many of the people that they supported prior, they're not Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and they have every right to do that as well. So this is really us more looking out for her, and also the many black folks who live in CD 26 or CD 22, they don't want to see her go either.
Corey Scheer is president of the Broward County Democratic Black Caucus. Mr. Scheer, many thanks.
Thank you so much, Tim. We really appreciate it. Again, our Black Caucus is here to represent black voters, to push on black issues, and we'll continue to do that proudly.
Thank you. Still to come, Haiti's desperately overdue presidential election gets postponed again. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Haiti has not held a presidential election since 2015. Under its constitution, one is supposed to be held every 5 years. But over the past decade, Haiti's gang violence and gang control has mushroomed. The capital, Port-au-Prince, is now under the rule of gangs, for all intents and purposes, that were responsible for more than 6,000 murders last year. That's made it too dangerous to send voters to the polls. With a new multinational police support mission called the Gang Suppression Force due to be deployed in Haiti, the country hoped a general election could happen in August. But last weekend, Acting Prime Minister Alix Didier Fils-Aimé said gang chaos still prevents it. As if to confirm that, Haiti's gangs then launched a new offensive, or new offensives, I should say, that human rights groups say killed more than 80 people in Port-au-Prince's Cité Soleil district. The question, with Haitian Flag Day on Monday, is when, if ever, can Haiti hold the election it so desperately needs? Joining me now in the studio is Jacqueline Charles, Haiti and Caribbean reporter for the Miami Herald, who follows Haiti's saga more closely and expertly than any journalist we know. Jackie, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
We'd like to hear your thoughts about Haiti's ongoing crisis, especially if you have friends and family there. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Jackie, there was a positive sign for Haiti last night, the arrival of the commander of the new U.S.-backed multinational gang suppression force, whose mission is to help neutralize Haiti's gangs. His name is Major General Edenebot Batsuri, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, from Mongolia. Is this an encouraging development, or is it still taking too long to get the more than 5,000-member gang suppression force deployed there?
So it depends on who you talk to. I mean, yeah. I've just had conversations in the last couple of days, and I'm being told that everything is on track. As a matter of fact, this is happening much more quickly than a normal, you know, UN deployment. And let me be clear, this is not a UN force,
no.
But it's very much operating under those similar constraints. First of all, in their own countries, they have to be prepared. They have to go through training. When they arrive in Haiti, and there's a little bit under 1,000 that are actually there, mm-hmm. they also have to go through 2 weeks of training, human rights training, mm-hmm. To make sure we don't have issues of rape, you know, excessive
right.
use of force. And so, but yes, Haitians are growing impatient when we see that the gangs have launched new offensives in Cité Soleil, in La Plaine, which is, you know, just east of the capital, and also in the Artibonite.
Yeah.
What you have the sense is that they are taking advantage of this transition between
uh-huh. yeah.
the departed MSS that was led by the Kenyans and mm-hmm. the yet to fully mobilize gang suppression force.
And most of the members of this gang suppression force at present that are there are from Chad?
Are from Chad, but mm-hmm. Mongolia. We also have Salvadorans, Guatemala, and you have Jamaicans. So you actually have 4 countries on the ground right
Why
now.
Why is a Mongolian major general heading this operation?
Because he's very experienced. He has mm-hmm. over 30 years of experience. He's worked in UN peacekeeping operations.
Okay, yeah.
And what I've been told is that he was handpicked specifically because of that experience and because mm-hmm. of his track record.
Interesting. So back to Prime Minister Fils-Aimé's announcement last weekend that a presidential election cannot be held after all in August, and his suggestion that one can take place at the end of the year. How hard a jolt was that for Haitians who've seen this desperately needed election put off time and again because of the gang violence?
Let me just say a couple of things about this. First of all, I never believed the elections were going to be held okay. this year. It didn't make any sense.
I can't blame you. Yeah.
You know, when your gang suppression force is not going to be up and running until the fall, mm-hmm. when did you think you were going to have an election in August?
Yeah.
That's number one. But number two, people forget we got into this crisis because of elections. And people, I'm sorry, have been fixated on the wrong thing. The time bomb is what kind of elections are you going to put out? Mm-hmm. The electoral law, as it stands right now, creates a boulevard for gang leaders, for people who are implicated in human rights abuses, for people who are carrying out extrajudicial killings, to basically run for office and to win political office. All of these individuals that have been sanctioned by the United States, by Canada,
and there the EU.
In the EU. There's mm-hmm. nothing stopping them from returning to office. Mm-hmm. And so do you think because you have sanctioned individuals that Haitian person who is now living in a gang-controlled territory, at least in Capital 1 and 4, mm-hmm. that they're going to go and they're going to say, well, I'm not going to vote for this person because the U.S. sanctioned him? No, there's no work that's been done. At the same time, 300-plus parties were basically given the green light, or they registered, I think, well, maybe now we're at 280 that's given the green light. So even in Haiti, people are not looking at how did we get into this mess and how do you get out of this mess and what guardrails need to take place in the law to basically limit the damage going forward.
Yeah, but all that said, Jackie, how jolting was it also to hear Haitian civic voices like human rights defender Pierre Esperance essentially call the prime minister's suggestion that an election can still be held by the end of the year a fantasy? I mean, Esperance said, in fact, quote, there's not even a 1% chance of that. So
I agree with Pierre Esperance.
Yeah, so
I
mean, he's bringing us back to reality.
It's back to reality. I've always thought it's 2027. And again, mm-hmm. How are you going to carry out these elections in a country where your two largest departments, which is the West, where Port-au-Prince is, the Lower mm-hmm. Artibonite, they represent 60% of the vote. How are you going to carry out those elections? And you still have phone issues, electricity issues. No one has told us yet how these elections are going to be staged.
Right. Well, sadly, Esperance seemed to be borne out when, right after, the Prime Minister Fils Aimé said there will be no presidential election in August because of the insecurity situation. The gangs mounted new offensives in the capital, Port-au-Prince, and in the interior, just north of the city, the Lower Artibonite, as you mentioned. Violence that human rights groups say killed about 80 people in the capital's Cité Soleil district. What brought on this new spasm of gang violence, and what does it tell you about the chances of holding an election by the end of this year or ever?
So the violence that we're seeing right now, it has come in spurts. It started in February on and off. We mm-hmm. saw the Haitian police and the army with the explosive drones really push some of these gang members back out of some of these territories. But as I'm talking to sources on the ground, they believe that there are political undertones because we are talking about elections, that now you see this new offensive by the gangs trying to control more and more territory. Because if I control territory, I control votes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that links this whole thing back to the elections issue. Yeah. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with the Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles about Haiti's presidential election yet again being postponed because of gang violence and when a desperately needed vote can ever be held there again. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Even if an election can be held, there has been some criticism of the new Haitian Election Council's rule that only parties that can prove they have at least 30,000 members can run. Many call that undemocratic and a nod to the country's old political elite. Many others call it an antidote to Haiti's historic elections chaos. Does this new election apparatus in Haiti have the confidence of people inside and outside the country, Jack? I mean, if an election can be held, will the apparatus of it, as you mentioned earlier, have people's confidence?
Look, in the last, two election cycles, what we've seen in terms of Haitian voters is they've had less and less confidence in the electoral system, in elections themselves. The numbers have gone down, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In a country of 12 million people, where today 1.5 million almost are basically displaced, 300 plus political parties. So what you're seeing here is an attempt by the CEP to sort of limit, how mm-hmm. many the chaos, so to speak.
Right, because hyper-democracy can be almost as bad as the lack of democracy in situations like this, no?
Yes, very much so. Yeah. I mean, but again, they're also asking for almost $300 million to pull off an election, which the prime minister says, we don't have that kind of money. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then they're also talking about changes, constitutional-type changes, which I'm not sure how you're going to pull that off in terms of how do you go and touch the Constitution without touching the Constitution. You say round one, you vote for a referendum, and then on round two, you're voting under a different constitutional, you know, rules. So what we're looking at is we could be headed for a real mess. And again, I go back to what I said in the beginning. We got into this mess because of elections, problematic elections. That has been at the root of Haiti's crisis for years.
But some people would say, and this week we saw, last Friday, we saw the conviction here in Miami in federal court of four of the people accused of conspiracy to assassinate Haitian President Jovenel Moïse back in 2021. And many would suggest that because of that, an election is so important because you need to bring back some sort of democratic and civic normalcy in Haiti, you know, to sort of erase that kind of violent chaos that we saw in 2021. Do they have a point that that factor makes an election so much more important?
I would tell you what I've seen is that people want elections now because they're exasperated. They're tired of the crisis. They're frustrated. They're fed up. They're ready to flip a page. Does it mean, though, that they believe in a process? Does it mean that we're going to see a higher voter turnout? I don't believe so. I think that people still have a lack of credibility. They don't really believe in the candidates. They don't see issues. Mm-hmm. There is no messiah, no Mandela that the outside world asks of, but people are just exasperated, right? Yeah. They're seeing things take place under a transitional government. They're saying that should not be the case. That should be for an elected government.
Right. And accountability, restoring accountability is so important precisely because of all those people involved in politics and gangs that you mentioned earlier. So we have Bernie on the line from West Palm Beach. Bernie, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Your thoughts?
Yes, my thought about the question is Haiti going to have an election for this year? And I said no. The reason why I said no is because, the way they are doing it, they're going to say, yes, we're going to have election in August. They're going to have election next year. In my mind, election will be probably in the next 2 years.
Next 2 years.
Because
then,
the situation it's so simple. So, for example, if I want to go to my country, my city right now, from here to my city, I have to pay $800 for one way of ticket. So meaning everybody is taking profit from the situation that it is. Mm-hmm. So how you think they're going to let that fix for people to get in?
All right. Well, thank you very much for your call, Bernie. We appreciate it.
The prime minister did say that people in the diaspora, at least in Miami, will be allowed to vote in the election, at least for president.
Mm-hmm. Nope. Good point. Finally, then, Jackie, just speaking of Haiti's democracy, I wanted to ask you about an important report you had in the Herald this week about the prime minister replacing the woman who heads the only ministry in Haiti dedicated to women's rights, replacing her and putting in a man in the position. What does that say about Haiti's democracy as we're moving forward?
So, yes, this was done out of the Ministry of Women's Affairs, the only ministry devoted to women's issues. And for your listeners, you have to understand, more than 50% of the people affected by this gang violence are women and girls.
Yes.
More than 50% of the people, of the 1.5 million who are displaced, are women and girls. The number of women and girls who were gang raped, last year was over 8,000. Okay, gender-based violence, but the majority of those cases were gang rapes. And so when you think about where you are now in terms of women, and we're not even talking about the fact that they are not represented, they're 22% represented in government, the country has not respected its own 30% quota in elected officials, that you take a woman with 30 years experience in the Ministry of Women's Affairs and you replace her with a man.
Yeah.
That is the issue, and we have not heard from Haitian authorities yet what they're going to do about it.
Jacqueline Charles is the Haiti and Caribbean reporter for the Miami Herald. Jackie, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Finally on the roundup, we can't avoid talking about Haiti's tragedy, but at the moment we also can't ignore Haiti's triumph, its first appearance in a men's soccer World Cup in more than 50 years.
Wanda Tima is the founder of L'Union Suite, one of the largest Haitian-American digital media platforms based here in South Florida. Tima said the World Cup gives her family a chance to cheer Haiti and tell the rich stories of Haitian players and culture.
Our community need these stories. We need to be reminded. We need to see who we are as a collective. And we also need to show people that we are not just political unrest. We are not just, you know, little kidnapping stories of what you're hearing coming out of primarily one city.
Haiti's players often hear Grenadier Lasso, which in Creole can mean soldiers attack or move ahead. It's a chant with roots in Haiti's fight for independence in the 18th and 19th centuries. Haitians embrace it as a statement of resilience both on and off the field. Paul Junior Prudent is a New York-based independent sports journalist who grew up in Haiti.
Look towards a brighter future. They think about Grenadier, especially in the U.S., Grenadier, Alasso. And despite what's going on politically, despite what's going on in the immigration here in the U.S., Grenadier, Alasso, let's go. That's the idea of that slogan. And I would like people, when they're in the stadium, chanting that chant.
Haiti will start its World Cup play next month on June 13th against Scotland. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.